Just breaking news story. Three locals at Anacortes locked their arms inside barrels full of cement on Tesoro's train tracks in Anacortes, Washington, this morning to protest oil by rail shipments in the Pacific Northwest. Anacortes is, of course, the base of a Tesoro refinery, which exploded 4 years ago, leading to the deaths of seven workers. Tesoro is currently planning to expand their refinery to process even greater quantities of oil for export. And on that note, this has been Air Cascadia for Monday, July 28th, 2014. Kate Welch engineered the show today. Thanks for that, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is, as always, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
The news is bad. Untold scores of traumatized children fleeing the violence engulfing their homes. The U.S. government and your tax dollars fueling the flames. Am I talking about Honduras, Gaza, Syria, or Iraq? No, I'm talking about our longest-running war, our 9/11 bomb 'em back to the Stone Ages war, Afghanistan. A human crisis of nearly incomprehensible proportions continues to unfold while other crises grab the headlines. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, for Wednesday Talk Radio. Call in and talk with guest Professor Zahair Wahab, just back from Kabul. Ask your questions and share your point of view on America's longest war. That's Wednesday Talk Radio with guest Professor Zahair Wahab, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This morning we're going to talk about how pesticides are a danger to salmon. Recently, a coalition of advocates for alternatives to pesticides, conservation organizations, and fishing groups reached a significant agreement with the Environmental Protection Agency that restores reasonable no-spray buffer zones to protect salmon and steelhead from five broad spectrum insect killers: diazinon, chlorpyrifos, malathion, carbaryl, and methomyl. My guests are Laurel Fulkerson, director of the Healthy Wildlife and Water Program for Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides, the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit that led to this agreement, and Stephen Mashuda, staff attorney in the Northwest Office of Earth Justice. They'll tell us about the repercussions of their lawsuit and the prospects of protecting salmon from toxic pesticide overuse. Stephen and Laurel, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
And you're in chorus. That's great. I want you to answer all the questions today together in two-part harmony. Well, stumbling over this list of broad-spectrum insect killers that are now banned from being sprayed close to salmon streams, that's a pretty scary list of killers, basically. And my first question, actually, is why are these pesticides even allowed anymore? And I'll throw that to you, Laurel, since this is part of your job, is to find alternatives to pesticides.
Sure. So these particular pesticides are, well, they're registered by the EPA. So just to give, I guess, a little background, pursuant to the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, before a pesticide product can be sold or distributed in the U.S., it has to be either exempted or registered with a label identifying approved uses by the EPA. So these particular pesticides were registered. I'll let Steve get into more details in terms of the litigation itself, but Steve, do you want to jump in terms of the background on the case, in terms of what we've gone through to sort of get these pesticides off their list?
So when they're registered, that means that they're basically approved for use for specific applications. And if they're exempted, what does that mean? If they're exempted?
Well, if they're, so yes, so anything that is registered can be used, and the ideally, if everything was working right under the implementation of all these laws, you would have the protections, any protections necessary or any prohibitions necessary would be included in that registration. But these things get registered and re-registered about once every 15 years or so. And all of these pesticides that we're talking about today were all registered probably starting in the late 60s. So these are pretty, as pesticides go, these are pretty old chemicals. And that's part of the reason why the lawsuit has focused on them, because they are kind of the worst of the worst in terms of their impacts to not only to salmon, but to other wildlife and to people as well, for that matter. And so we've focused or targeted these particular pesticides first because they are the ones that cause the most harm. And again, if we had a regulatory system that was functioning as it's, you know, it was probably intended to, there probably wouldn't be that much of a need for litigation in order to get protections that ought to have been, you know, built into these registrations and these licenses in the process of where EPA is evaluating whether or not, you know, people could use them.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the lawsuit, I'm curious about why these five pesticides are still being used. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of hoopla about the most famous one, of course, being DDT that was banned a long time ago. But my understanding of these pesticides is they're probably just as dangerous as DDT. So why we get rid of one horrible pesticide and then there seems like another 500 crop up to replace it?
Right, right. No, and I think that's right. I mean, I would say if you ask the question of why these pesticides are still in use to a grower, you would probably get an answer that is something along the lines of because they're the chemicals that do the most damage and result in the you know, sometimes in the least cost or the, you know, least number of applications, and we know their dangers, and we, you know, or, you know, there's sort of the devil we know, right? If you ask that question of an activist or a salmon fisherman, I think you would get back the same question. Yes, why are these pesticides still being used when we know so much about how bad they are for the health of the health of wildlife and for human health? And that's really, you know, EPA has banned a few of these. A lot of these are organophosphate pesticides. They're a class of nerve agents, and they are. Several of them have been banned over the years or significantly curtailed. Most recently, I think, is one called azinphos methyl, or AZM, which, you know, the evidence started mounting, you know, as early as the 70s, I believe, about its ill effects, and it was just banned here within the last several years. And again, that's what, you know, these things take so long, and until we're no longer using these chemicals, we sort of targeted the how can we at least prevent harm to the extent we can from some of these.
Well, I understand now why you chose these chemicals. So the other question I have before we get into the details of the lawsuit is, why did you focus on their application close to salmon streams?
Sure. So I can touch on that one. So the organophosphate and carbamate insecticides, as you mentioned, are some of the worst of the worst. They're neurotoxins, so they disrupt the nervous systems of target organisms, which are the insects, but also non-target organisms, so the fish. At high concentrations, they can actually kill fish outright. At lower concentrations, they do all sorts of terrible things, alter their swimming ability, predator recognition, salmon's, you know, and steelhead populations' ability to actually get back to their natal streams to spawn. In addition, they kill invertebrates, which are the insects that the fish rely on for food. So, you know, in national, and we'll discuss this, but as National Marine Fisheries Service themselves have said, they're extremely damaging to these salmon and steelhead populations. So we originally learned of the growing threat of pesticides to salmon and steelhead in 1999. We published a report with Oregon Environmental Council and a number of other groups called Diminishing Returns, Salmon Decline and Pesticides. And that report showed that even low concentrations of these pesticides can result in salmon mortality, both through direct fish kills and sublethal effects. So that was a sort of why we initially focused on these particular pesticides.
Well, reading through your press releases and the agreement document that the EPA put out, it seemed, I sort of gathered, and I'm a little bit fuzzy about this, but it looks like there was a ban on spraying these pesticides within a reasonable buffer from salmon streams that went into effect at some point, I couldn't tell when, and then it, I guess in 2004, and then it expired in 2007, and it's taken until now to get it reinstated. So I'm curious, what was the motive, what was the motivation for the ban initially, and then why was it allowed to expire?
Well, I'll take a shot at that, and Laurel, you can fill in some blanks. So the initial ban came about as a lawsuit that we brought on behalf of Laurel's organization and many others back in the early part of the 2000s. And there's a provision in the Endangered Species Act that when you boil it down to its essence, it basically says that when one federal agency authorizes or takes an activity, it has to go consult with the National Marine Fisheries Service, in the case of salmon, to see if that activity is going to impact salmon, and if so, what they need to do to make sure it doesn't. And as Laurel mentioned initially, these are all registered by EPA. The problem is that EPA keeps registering these pesticides without going to the Fisheries Service to ask, you know, are these going to have an impact on salmon runs? And we brought a lawsuit back in 2002 that resulted in a 2004 court ruling and an injunction that said you need to, until that process can actually take place, that consultation process, you need to not spray these pesticides within certain buffers around streams. And what happened was that usually 99.9% of the time you have that consultation process go forward and the agencies come out the other end with a set of restrictions that the agency taking the action will usually immediately implement and go forward. What happened here is you had that consultation process, and the Fisheries Service came out and said, yep, these pesticides are really bad for salmon. We need big buffers around streams and some other measures to reduce the ability of these pesticides to get into waterways. And the EPA said, thanks for your input. We're going to sit on it. And so that resulted in the lawsuit that has preceded this settlement, because the groups working on this had waited for EPA to implement these things, had asked EPA to implement these protections, and EPA not really refused. They just were silent. And so the only recourse was to go back to court to get them to do something again, and so here we are.
Well, it's kind of curious to me, since this is the EPA under the Obama administration as opposed to under the George W. Bush administration.
Right.
So I wonder, Lisa Jackson took a lot of fire for taking some pretty strong positions, and then also fire from environmentalists for backpedaling on some of them. But was there politics going on at EPA which made it hard for them to do anything about these buffer zones?
In short, yes, I think. I mean, there's a very long history here, stretching back even into the late 80s, with pesticides and the Endangered Species Act. And to sum all of that up, I think it's fair to say that the EPA thinks that the way it has been doing business for 25 years or more on pesticide registrations is the right way. There's a whole department within EPA that handles pesticides, and I think it's, again, fair to say that those folks think that the way that they've been doing things has been right. The Fisheries Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service have come in, as the Endangered Species Act has come into play since the 80s, and said, well, no, we think you're not being nearly protective enough of wildlife. You're focusing on other things. You're not really looking at the impacts of these pesticides in the real world. And so we had this really almost 20 years of interagency disputes about how to evaluate these pesticides and how to assess their very real harm. That culminated in a National Academies of Science report that came out in 2013, where the National Academies basically said, yeah, all of you federal agencies need to get your act together, get on the same page. And by the way, EPA, most of the way that the wildlife agencies have been viewing these things is correct, and so you need to change the way you're doing these evaluations. And that has started to spur some change. But we haven't sort of seen the fruits of that yet, but it really has woken up, I think, people at EPA and the other agencies to really tackle this problem finally. But until we get there, until we can, you know, quote unquote, solve this, we really do need some interim protections, and that's what we have developed in this settlement.
Well, if you just tuned in, my guests this morning are Laurel Fulkerson, who's with the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides, and Stephen Mashuda, who's a staff attorney in the Northwest Office of Earth Justice. And we're talking about an agreement that their groups have reached via lawsuit with the EPA to reinstate buffer zones that protect salmon streams from 5 very virulent insecticides. So let's talk about the lawsuit itself and what was we've gotten sort of a sense of what the goal of the lawsuit is, but how did you go about, or how did you decide that you were going to do a lawsuit? And particularly, it's interesting that I'd like to know from Laurel why your organization, which is not known as a great litigating organization like Earth Justice, why did you become the lead plaintiff?
Sure. So, as I mentioned, in 1999, we came out with that report on the effects of pesticides on salmon. I think it became really apparent to us how big of an issue it was. I think also during that time, we realized that the EPA had never complied with its mandate under the Endangered Species Act to consult on the impacts of pesticides on threatened endangered salmon steelhead. So in the entire time of the act, the agency had never actually looked at, you know, the effects of these pesticides, and as Steve mentioned, continued to register these pesticides with no real thought to the effect on salmon and steelhead populations. So that's when we initially got involved, and it was an important enough issue for us to actually file a suit, because they were actually claiming that they didn't have to consult under the Endangered Species Act, that their mandate under FIFRA to register pesticides and their assessment under FIFRA, where they had a requirement to ensure no unreasonable adverse effects, was sufficient. And we, you know, obviously didn't believe that was the case. And the court agreed with us. So that's sort of how we first got involved. These particular 54 insecticides and herbicides were sort of the worst of the worst from what we could tell from our research. So that's how that got started.
Well, does the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides have any history prior to taking on this fight to being involved in litigation?
No, this is actually our only lawsuit. So, you know, we just felt it was an important enough issue. And I think at this point, I mean, in addition to, you know, trying to get the EPA to actually move forward and implement permanent protection measures, one of the key things we're working on is really working with growers to implement alternatives. So that's another piece for us that's really important. And we've done some outreach with growers so far to really help them implement less toxic alternatives to combat these pests.
Well, I'm sorry, continue.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, I'm trying to remember, like, the history of your organization, and I might have this confused with a predecessor to you, but I remember in the 70s there was a big struggle that went on around spraying, I think it was 2,4-5-T, in the LC Valley, and there were cancer clusters as a result, and there were a group of women who banded together in the valley and basically were able to stop the spraying of 2,4-5-T and also 2,4-D. Which are the two ingredients of Agent Orange? And I don't know if was that organized, were those people connected at all with the eventual formation of NCAP?
Early on, I'm not sure. I've not been around quite that long. We've been around for about 37 years, and our initial focus was on spraying and on forest lands.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's it, because this was forest lands, down the road over to Walport. Because it seemed like that was a big success to stop spraying 2,4-5-T in the forests. But what seems to have come in the ensuing 37 years is that there are so many things that are being sprayed that you've got a huge number of battles ahead of you. I'm wondering if you see what would your goal be for not just getting these insecticides banned from 60 feet from the stream sides, or aerial spraying. What is it? It's
300 feet.
Right.
300 feet aerial.
Which still.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, National Marine Fisheries Service said, you know, for these particular five insecticides, the buffer should be much larger. They said, 500 feet aerial. I believe in was it? No, sorry, 500 feet on the ground and 1,000 feet aerial. Is that correct, Steve?
Yes, that was their. That was their finding.
Yeah, I'd be really concerned about drift. I mean, even at 60 feet on the ground, seems like it could easily drift.
Yeah, so this was sort of a, this is a compromise. Obviously the agency itself, thought the buffer should be much larger. Until we can actually get additional biological opinions and the EPA to act, this is a compromise interim protection. So we really, are hoping for much larger protections in the long term.
Now, let's get to the other goal that was sort of alluded to earlier, that you'd like to see all these chemicals banned, actually. So I'm wondering, on what fronts are you working to eventually achieve the demise of these five chemicals and probably several others as well?
Well, so this is just, as we mentioned, five of I guess there's 37 where they said, NIMS said there would be jeopardy to salmon and steelhead. So, depending on how quickly they act, with those additional chemicals, there may be additional lawsuits, and we're actually working at the federal level as well. I'm sitting on a committee, Pesticide Program Dialogue Committee, which actually works directly with the EPA and a number of other groups and state agencies. So we're trying, at the EPA level to make some progress there as well. But we've seen inaction so far here, so. Which is why we turned to litigation in the first place.
Well, I find it. Go ahead, Stephen.
Oh, I was going to say, I think I was the one speaking of the ban too, and just to make sure I'm not painting with too broad a brush. I mean, there are efforts underway to ban several of these chemicals. I'm not educated enough to know if others are working to ban, all five of them. But I think certainly within, if you talk about the impacts within sensitive species habitat. There is an effort to make sure that we're not getting these chemicals into those habitats, because the one thing that I think is important to realize about all this and why we keep talking about buffers is that once these things are in the stream, the harm is done. There's not really anything you can do other than trying to prevent these from reaching the stream. And in some cases, and because these chemicals are so bad, the doses that are harmful to organisms are so low that you really need, and that's why people and the Fisheries Service are looking at, buffers of 1,000 feet for aerial spraying, because that would reduce significantly the concentrations that would enter streams, such that maybe in some instances it would prevent it altogether. In other instances, it would make sure that at least whatever does reach the stream reaches it in such small amounts. There is an effort that I just wanted to mention that a number of other organizations and individuals are working on to ban the chemical chlorpyrifos, one of the organophosphates, because of its impacts on human health. So there's a whole arena outside the wildlife work that we're talking about here, where people are looking at some of these chemicals and the mounting evidence of impacts on human health. And using that as the basis to ban the sale of those.
Well, that's actually what I was going to get to next, which is that I find it interesting and refreshingly non-human chauvinist that you're using wildlife habitat protection as the the hammer, let's say, to try to ban these chemicals, because what's bad for salmon is also bad for humans, I would think. And I mean, just looking down this list, that some of these I'm familiar with, and they can't possibly be good for humans to have any contact with them. I mean, I'm thinking in particular, this drift, and there's people, neighbors and people who are going to be contacted by the application of these chemicals, but just the people who are doing the application, I would really wonder about their health as well.
Right. Exactly. And I think the great, and really in some ways beautiful paradox here is that, you know, we have very strong laws to protect wildlife from harm, and in some instances we're seeing that those laws are potentially more direct, and at least in the way they're implemented, a more direct path to getting protections that help not only fish and not only wildlife but also people, especially when you're talking about water. And Laurel can probably speak more about this, but you know, there's great concern of keeping these chemicals out of, you know, municipal and private water supply, and you know, it just so happens that salmon are also in a lot of those waters, so there's a very happy a crossover.
Well, Laurel, why don't you expand on that? Because your organization has been very involved in protecting people from pesticides as well as wildlife.
Yes, we have, and I mean, these particular pesticides that we're looking at in the settlement, the chlorpyrifos and carbaryl, have exceeded state water quality standards, both in Oregon and in California. It's been a huge issue, and I think there's been a lot of question about, you know, the impacts on human health. And I think that's something that, interestingly, people don't focus on as much with this, and I think there haven't been as many, you know, and Steve, I'm not as familiar with that particular effort you mentioned with chlorpyrifos, but I know that's something that, you know, people are looking at here in terms of, you know, those exceedances. I know Oregon Environmental Council and others have been focusing on that. So it's definitely a huge issue.
Well, I want to kind of throw in a curveball now for you guys, and I want to talk about some of the other pesticides that are not on your list that you're not suing against, but that have gotten a lot of publicity. And the first one are the bee killers. I think the neoconids, is that what they're called?
Neonicotinoids.
Yeah. Right. Which are, you know, there's hundreds of petitions online right now to get this, to try to stop them. And then the other thing that's also been interesting to me is that the glyphosates Roundup is becoming scrutinized a lot more, and I guess studies are coming out that are showing that it's not particularly safe either, and that's perhaps the most widely applied pesticide of any that I can think of. So I wonder how your suit dovetails into these other struggles to stop this use of a lot of other very harmful insecticides and other pesticides.
So we're also working on the neonicotinoid issue. So I work on pollinators as well, and that's a huge problem right now. I think there's growing evidence of the effects on pollinators in particular, and we're working with Congressman Blumenauer's office here to try and pass the Saving America's Pollinators Act, which would actually require the EPA to basically study the effects of neonicotinoids on pollinators and prevent their use until they can prove that they're not actually negatively impacting pollinators. This is a whole other issue where the EPA hasn't actually done the studies and actually really looked at the effects of these particular pesticides on pollinators in particular.
Well, so, I know it's like the producers, the manufacturers of the neonicotinoids have been like trying to find all kinds of other reasons why there's been big bee die-offs. And I'm wondering if the really notorious, particularly the bumblebee die-off, I think it was in Wilsonville last year. And then mm-hmm. there was another one down towards Eugene not that long ago. I guess it's conclusive that it's the neonicotinoids that are killing the bees. Do you feel that the debate is over as far as whether or not neonicotinoids are in fact responsible for wiping out wide swaths of pollinators, and that the discussion needs to move from what's the cause to how do we stop the cause that we know is there?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that neonicotinoids are definitely a contributing factor. There's a ton of research and evidence to that effect. I think it's somewhat disturbing that the EPA hasn't actually, based on all of those studies and all the documentation out there, done their job to move forward and actually restrict use until, they complete their studies and, as they are required to. So, yes, I absolutely agree. And I think, there's a number of different efforts at the state level to prevent use of gene nicotinoids. There's also been a number of different bans in Eugene. They banned use of them on city property. They're the first city in the country to do that. Spokane, Washington, recently passed an ordinance that would prohibit their use on city property there as well. So I think understanding of that issue is growing. There's a big movement to also prohibit their use in the marketplace. So there's been a big effort to move Home Depot and Lowe's to not carry products with neonicotinoids, both plants that have been treated and products themselves. Unfortunately, Lowe's hasn't really done much on that yet. Home Depot has actually agreed to at least label those products. But I think what I see there is a big issue is people aren't really aware of the fact that many plants where they're trying to, people are trying to provide pollinator habitat are actually treated with neonicotinoids, which harm pollinators because they're a systemic pesticide. So the plants that are treated actually take it up in its entirety, and it gets into the pollen and the nectar and causes all sorts of issues with bees in terms of, their ability to get back to their hives, their disorientation, and sometimes, as you've seen in Wilsonville and some other areas more recently in Eugene, outright, major bee kills.
Well, this morning we're talking with Laurel Fulkerson, who's the director of the Healthy Wildlife and Water Program for the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides, and Stephen Mashuda, who's a staff attorney in the Northwest Office of Earth Justice. And we started out talking about a lawsuit that they filed, which has resulted in an agreement with the EPA to reinstate, I guess we would all agree, rather narrow buffer zones to protect salmon from salmon streams from spraying of five really virulent insecticides. And we're moving on now to some other things beyond the purview of the lawsuit, looking at other pesticide issues. Laurel, you mentioned in the beginning of the show that one of the things that your organization does is to really work with growers to help them find alternatives to pesticides, and that's the name of your group. So I'd like to know, what kinds of alternatives do you have to offer growers, and what kind of success are you having in getting farmers to rethink their relationship to pests?
Sure. So most recently, in terms of the salmon work, we've done some outreach to growers in Hood River and the Dalles, really to determine, how these buffers are going to affect them and then how we can help them implement alternatives to these insecticides in an effort to protect water quality. Through the outreach, we learned that chlorpyrifos, malathion, carbaryl, which are all at issue in this particular settlement, are commonly used in Hood River and the Dalles for orchards. We were, frankly, really pleased to learn about some efforts to reduce the use of those pesticides through alternative methods as part of the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership approach, which is a Oregon state-led approach in collaboration with watershed councils, growers, Oregon Environmental Council, a number of others, that has actually been very successful in implementing alternatives. So one example, which is actually about 14 years ago, chlorpyrifos was actually detected at well above water quality standards for fish in the Hood River watershed, and it was being used to combat codling moths in apple and pear orchards through a combination of voluntary best management practices and the use of trapping and pheromones to disrupt mating of the moths. They were able to reduce the concentrations of chlorpyrifos by 90% in that particular watershed. So it's sort of just one illustration of how, alternatives can be used to protect water quality. We're looking at also another issue with malathion in the Dalles, where a rise of the fruit fly spotted ring Drosophila in 2012 actually resulted in an increase of the use of malathion. So it had been previously reduced in that particular watershed, but because of this new fruit fly pest, it's actually recently increased in cherry orchards. So we've been speaking with a lot of cherry orchards who are interested in implementing alternatives to address spotted-winged Drosophila, and are looking forward to working with them to obtain funding for research on trainings on alternatives and really you know, trying to address this pest. And we're working with Oregon State University, so we're hoping to put on some trainings in the Dalles here. It'll probably be the beginning of next year. Really trying to, you know, focus on teaching, you know, and helping folks learn how to implement these alternatives to address them. So that's just a couple of examples.
How receptive are the farmers to giving up their use of pesticides? Because it seems like pesticide use is sort of like a drug addiction, and it's a lot easier to go out and spray with these really harmful chemicals than it is to do much more integrated pest management.
You know, so far in our outreach, people are very receptive to it. I think the problem has been that they just don't, you know, like with malathion and spotted-winged Drosophila, it's a huge issue that people are trying to figure out how to reduce the use of malathion. I think most of the folks, that, at least that I've talked to, are really good stewards. They actually care about protecting their land and the natural resources on their land, but just haven't had, you know, access to alternatives. And so I think they're wanting to do that. I think the problem has just been that there haven't been enough training and enough, you know, perhaps research on alternatives. So we're really trying to get additional funding at both the state and federal levels to do that. But I think, you know, I think that they really want to do that.
Well, I know of a number of farms, both certified organic and ones that aren't certified, but do conduct very sustainable practices, and where they work with wildlife basically to control the pests. Because I'm thinking, like, mosquitoes might be a real pest to us, but they're not a pest to birds. They're kind of a vital part of their diet. So I'm wondering, are you working also with that kind of integrated pest management and helping people to appreciate that? I mean, it means that they might have some more spots on their produce than they're used to, but that they might be doing something that's a real service both to their customers and to the environment.
Definitely. I mean, I know for spider-winged Drosophila, they're looking at, you know, wasps and other, you know, other predators that can help reduce the levels of those populations. So yeah, we're looking at that as an alternative, and that's something that OSU, you know, they've done some research on that particular pest and using, you know, parasitoids to actually address them. So we're looking into that and multiple other levels through, you know, an integrated pest management approach.
Well, let's get back to your lawsuit now against the EPA and the settlement that you have. And what are the next steps? What's going to be happening? And do you ever expect that not only will there be these minimal buffers reinstated, but in fact someday there'll be no spraying at all?
Well, I'll tackle the next steps first. I think the so let's see, just in terms of process and what happens after this. So this settlement agreement EPA wanted to put out for public comment for 30 days, which with, you know, we obviously didn't have a problem with. Public input is always a good thing. And so that comment period ended in early July. And what will happen now is that we expect to hear from the agency within the next couple of weeks. And that settlement will be sort of signed on the dotted line and filed with the court. When you look at the, what's interesting, and you look at the public comment that came in on this agreement, you know, I think there were only about 100 comments received, and I think 97 or 98 of those were positive, you know, encouraging and sometimes short but to the point statements of support. And there were only a couple from some of the industry groups that. You know, either were complaining about the fact that it was a settlement, or raised a minor technical point. So there, in other words, there wasn't a hue and cry from, you know, all corners about this agreement. So I believe it has a smooth path to, you know, being signed and filed and finalized. And then what will happen is there are many different provisions, and one of the things that we worked very closely with the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides to do was to make sure that this agreement gets publicized and communicated to the people who matter, which are the people who would, you know, might reach for one of these pesticides. And there's a number of provisions in that agreement that where EPA will be doing some public notice and outreach to various university extensions and, you know, the various agricultural commissions on the West Coast in California, Washington, and Oregon. And then I know the Northwest Center has planned its own ongoing outreach to farmers and growers to get the word out that this this agreement is in effect.
But there'd be no labeling on the packaging for the sprays.
Well, no, because that labeling's sort of already out there in the world. There will be a prominent notice on EPA's website about this, and some part of the you know, the notification proceedings that we wanted to get in this agreement are so that people know that they need to go to the website to find out exactly what they can and can't do and where they can and can't do it. So there'll be maps on EPA's website. There will be details about the restrictions, a lot of information, but with the end result or the intent of someone, again, who might reach for one of these chemicals can go and figure out where they can and can't use it, which may influence or may not influence whether they use it at all, but at least they'll be apprised of what the requirements are.
Well, if there's a farmer with an orchard and most of the orchard's within 60 feet of a salmon stream, which is mm-hmm. probably unlikely, but, I mean, obviously that farmer would find some other solution rather than using one of these five sprays.
Right.
But let's say that the farmer has he has hundreds of acres and there's just 10% of his orchard is along the salmon stream. In that case, do you think that he would still be applying these chemicals?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the one thing that, as Laura was mentioning before, the one thing that does impact people's use of pesticides and particularly in agriculture is that these cost money. It costs money to buy these chemicals. They're expensive. It costs money to apply them. And so as we saw from 2004 to 2008, when these requirements were in force previously, the sky did not fall on agriculture. People figured out how to reach for alternatives or to do different practices. And so what's most likely to occur, and what there's some evidence, at least anecdotal, that occurred last time around, was that the switch would be, you know, from, say, chlorpyrifos to something that is far less toxic or to integrated pest management techniques that you use over the whole orchard, as opposed to trying to treat different areas with different things, which can get burdensome and a little bit more difficult.
So long term, what are your hopes for this agreement, and do you see down the line where you could push to actually get these five insecticides banned and maybe more as well?
Well, I think I'll tackle that one first. I think the long term, really what needs to happen is some rationality and some protection to be brought to the issue of pesticides and their impact on wildlife. And I think that, I mentioned the National Academy study and the fact that the agencies are huddling and trying to figure out how they can get along and how they can get these consultations completed and protections in place. So long term, I really believe and hope that that's where this is going. And whether those processes and consultations result in additional restrictions or bans on some of these chemicals, it's hard to say at this point. But hopefully, whether they're still allowed for some uses or whether they're altogether banned, their effects will not be visited on wildlife and people down the line.
So we are almost out of time, but Laurel, I wanted to give you last words.
Sure. I mean, I think for us, long-term, yes, we'd like to see EPA implement permanent protection measures to these particular pesticides. I think also, you know, as I mentioned, I think it's really important to develop alternatives and really get the word out to growers that there are alternatives that they can use that will both help them with pests and protect water quality and salmon on their land.
Great. Well, I'll touch base with both of you later on in the fall after the period, after hopefully the agreement becomes law, whatever it becomes,
final,
right, and what the next steps are. Because it's really good talking to you, and I really support your struggle. So thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Great.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Sure. We've been talking this morning with Laurel Fulkerson, who's with the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides, and Stephen Mashuda with Earth Justice, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, Locus Focus goes on break again until September 15th, when my guest will be Dominic Della Sala to talk about the Tongass rainforest. And in the meantime, I'll be finishing up a documentary I'm working on with my partner Elaine Velasquez, so have some more news about our documentary on food justice come late this fall as well. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Milton Nascimento and Wayne Shorter, Miracle of the Fishes. Thanks for listening.
Eu vejo esses peixes se vão de coração. Eu vejo essas matas e vão de coração. And it is 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Disability Awareness with host Grace Eagle Reed. Her guest today is Laura. Oh, Laura. Well, she'll introduce you to her guest. And do stay tuned at 11:30. We will hear Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. Today's guests are psychology researchers David Feldman and Lee Daniel Kravitz, authors of the new book, Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. And we also would like to extend a big thank you to all our listeners that support the radio station, KBOO. If you are not a member of KBOO, go on over to kboo.fm. and click on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the album release party for Tribal Essence Volume 2 on Friday, August 8th at 10 p.m. There will be two floors of psychedelic trance and downtempo music curated by DJ Water with performances, art, and special guests. Tribal Essence Volume 2 release party will take place at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information, including a list of performers, can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible